Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
Pretty good pace of placements for cattle during the month of January, which was a particular interest given the fact that we were not receiving cattle imports from Mexico during the month.
Looking at the latest cattle on feed report from USDA, which came out on Friday, USDA livestock analyst Mike McConnell.
So the fact that we were higher than a year ago indicates that there was still pretty strong pull from producers to place their cattle in feedlots. Some of the major themes going on during the month continue to be high cattle prices, both for fed cattle that are being marketed, as well as feeder cattle that are coming into feedlots. And it's interesting to note, just despite the fact that we eclipsed over $200 per head in the fed steer market for the month of January, we still saw markings above a year ago. That, along with the wholesale beef prices, indicates that there's still pretty strong demand for beef within the United States and in our export markets, and those prices are working their way through the cattle market.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
I would be remiss not to acknowledge that the last 2 years have been difficult and financially stressful in the pig business.
Daryl Timmerman is past president of the Minnesota Pork Producers, speaking recently before the Minnesota Senate Ag Committee.
The pig farmer operates largely without a safety net. And frankly, we aren't typically asking for one, but what we do seek is limiting undue burdens that make it even harder for family farmers to endure through difficult market troughs. In September of 2022, the Iowa State Estimated Livestock Returns Model, they reported the first of what would be a 19-month string of losses in the U.S. wine industry. It wasn't until March of 2024 that model resulted in there being profitability. During that time frame, there was $27 of losses on every single pig that went to market. That was the average for that time frame. Certainly some times were worse and some were better, but that was the average. And so to put that into context, that's about $4,700 of losses on every semi-truck that you met going down the road, sustained for 19 months.
Top culprit? Inflation.
Driven mainly by the rising of the extreme inflationary feed costs, labor, and other supply chain challenges, Minnesota's pig farmers have felt significant financial pressures to evaluate their expenses and efficiencies. Certainly a challenging time, but we're optimistic that the future will begin to restore profitability. And starting in April of last year, that did take place. And so things are moving in the right direction, but certainly a lot of equity to put back on the balance sheets.
But they also persevered.
While growth has been relatively stagnant for the last 5 years, we saw significant opportunity and therefore growth in our business from the late 90s right up until the pandemic. Minnesota was home to some key advantages that set our state apart. First, it takes progressive, savvy farmers to navigate the many challenges of raising pigs, none of which makes Minnesota a great place to raise pigs as possible without the cultural values of family farming. Despite increased consolidation, market access challenges, and market volatility, Minnesota pig farmers found a way to persevere and become a significant economic driver for the state's economy. In 2023, more than 30,000 jobs in Minnesota were connected to the pork industry, and as an industry, contributed $3.3 billion to the state's GDP. Second, Minnesota is uniquely positioned with supporting industries like pork processing, ready access to key feedstuffs, primarily corn, and key byproducts like DDGs and soybean meal. There's key resources in veterinary medicine and transportation that all make raising animals and getting them to market efficient and affordable. Keeping pigs healthy is the number one resource or number one priority for farmers. Working closely with industry-leading veterinarians, many of whom are based here in Minnesota, has helped farmers make strides in improving the overall health of our swine herd. The network of businesses and enterprises that support Minnesota's pork industry increase our endurance and resiliency. Third, Minnesota farmers can fully utilize and upcycle a valuable byproduct from pigs, which is manure. Manure is a valuable resource to nutrients for raising the crops that become the feed we provide for our animals. We have some of the richest soils in the world, and by utilizing manure instead of commercial fertilizer, farmers can build soil health and protect our water quality. Feed represents the single most expensive cost for raising pigs. In Minnesota last year, we sold 16 million market pigs. Feed made up 55% of the cost to raise each and every one of those animals. Manure helps reduce the financial and environmental footprint of feed.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Some of the things that get said around here, you just shake your head.
Arizona Representative David Schweiker.
Think about some of the things we're hearing from the press, from the Democrats, you know, just panic stricken. I need to actually walk the American people and our own staff through a little bit of facts and a little bit of the truth. We've done multiple presentations here saying, if you want to find waste and fraud, if you want to find programs that are misdesigned, other things that are going on, don't hire a bunch of lawyers. Don't actually hire a bunch of investigators. Hire data scientists. It turns out the truth is in the math. The math actually can tell you. So what was amusing is listening to some of the Democrats talk about, you know, we don't want people seeing our data. Okay, maybe they should actually pay attention to the current law. When you hear certain leftist groups, and most of these are actually fairly left, saying, we did an analysis of U.S. taxpayer data and blank, blank, blank is getting this. Well, actually, understand, and IRS is one of my things I oversee. For decades, apparently, they've had data sharing models for researchers. And, you know, not to give you the names, but, you know, Harvard, University of Sydney. So they're not even domestic. Some are even out of the country. And yes, there's some rules. But the fact of the matter is this sort of hyperventilation going on around here. Have you wondered if it's because the ability to mine data is how you find bad acts? Look what the Wall Street Journal did over the last year in looking at Medicare. It wasn't about people's benefits. It was about actually people being defrauded in durable medical equipment. Other groups out there did data sharing, modeling, research agreements with CMS, and they found bad acts. So my simple question is, why has the left actually become terrified of data? Aren't they ones that preached to us in the previous years, what about science? Why don't you believe in science? Okay, guess what? Now science is actually being used to protect the U.S. taxpayers and America's future, instead of being used to research things, to write papers to support a leftist cause. Maybe they're actually now being used to actually find how the American people are being cheated. So when you hear them hyperventilating and reading the talking points from the Public Employees Union, maybe take a step backwards. Deal with the fact that much of what you is being put out is like clickbait. But understand, these research agreements have been going on for years and years and years. And what's going on now, these folks are actually designated, I think, as special federal employees. So even a higher level of standard fiduciary responsibility. So, look, this is just part of the thing around here. When you get something you don't like, or when you start to expose decades worth of bad acts, fight like hell because the Public Employees Union functionally supports one side here. And we're just trying to find out what's actually going on.
But time's running out.
In the previous year, I think we had 3 months where we had to borrow money to pay for our borrowing. For every dime we will take in tax collections this year, we're going to spend a dollar, I think it's $1.36. Which is an improvement. Last year was $1.39. It doesn't have to be this way. We just have to start telling the truth, tell the truth about the math, tell the truth to each other, and toughen up.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Window assist with calving.
Dr. Mark Johnson is Oklahoma State Beef Extension Breeding Specialist.
Our topic this week is window assist with calving, and we dig into that a little deeper by addressing the three stages of bovine parturition. And understanding those three stages and what goes on in each is helpful when deciding if we need to assist a cow or heifer in the process. First stage, basically, is a little bit of dilation of the cervix. This can happen over hours or days. We may not notice this happening, or we may notice that cows or heifers have kind of separated themselves off from the herd. Perhaps they've lost a little bit of appetite. We may see a mucus string hanging from the vulva. Again, it can be a very deliberate process or something that happens pretty quick, but typically is easy to go unnoticed. Stage 2 is the actual delivery of the calf. This is kind of where the actions at, so to speak. Stage two officially begins when we see presentation of the water bag at the vulva. And when we see the presentation of the water bag, we always say that's when we want to start our clock. There's ample research that shows that with a normal presentation of the calf, a mature cow is going to calve within 30 minutes of when we actually see the water bag. Now, a heifer that's not as large in her pelvic area and has not had a calf before can take up to 60 minutes after we see the water bag to actually calve. And so those are timelines to keep in mind. If we're looking at a mature cow, after we see the water bag, we should expect her to calve in about 30 minutes. A heifer can take up to 60. Stage three is actually shedding of the placental membranes or shedding the placenta. That's usually going to happen within 6 to 12 hours after the presentation of the calf. If we ever see retained placentas, we don't want to get aggressive in trying to pull those out. That is a topic actually for next week when we talk about how to address retained placenta in cow herds. But if we actually see that for a few days, we may want to administer some antibiotics or get in touch with our vet. So, back to this process of stage two and how do we decide when we need to potentially assist with calving. Keep those timelines in mind. And if we see a cow or heifer that's not making adequate progress, or even one that looks like we're not seeing a water bag, but she's been struggling and straining for a while, we're probably going to need to do a vaginal exam. We want to keep cleanliness in mind. We want to be gentle. We want to wear protective gloves, OB sleeves, have lubricant, some kind of cleanser. And when we go in, if everything is normal in the presentation and the cervix is fully dilated, we're not going to feel much of that cervix. We're going to be able to feel the front feet of the calf. We should feel the split between the front toes on top, the dew claws underneath, and right behind that and above those front feet, we're going to feel the nose of the calf. If we can palpate and get a little farther back, the spine of that calf is going to be directly below the spine of the cow. That's how we're going to confirm we have a normal presentation. If the water bag is still intact when we go in and do that, we've still got some time to potentially give that heifer or cow the opportunity to have that calf on her own. If the water bag is broken at that point, we're going to need to proceed with actually manual assistance in getting that calf out. If we've got an abnormal presentation, we know that that vet-client relationship is critical at times like this. We're going to want to get in touch with our veterinarian because we may need assistance there. So that's a little bit on when to decide if we need to assist with calving, the three stages of parturition. I hope this helps, and I hope nobody has to pull a calf this year during spring calving season.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
So the renewable fuel standard was part of the last energy bill passed in 2007. In that bill, there was a schedule, a statutory schedule that said this amount of fuel, renewable fuel, needed to be blended on an annual basis, and it was incrementally higher year over year. That statutory schedule ran out in 2022.
Troy Breedenkamp is Senior Vice President, Government and Public Affairs with the Renewable Fuels Association.
After 2022, we're midway through the Biden administration, and they now, by statute, whoever's in charge of the government at the time, or the EPA, is responsible for setting whatever that renewable volume obligation will be from 2022 and beyond. So the Biden administration took first crack at that. They did a three-year set rule, is the way we refer to it, for 23, 24, and 25. In many ways, they did pretty good. From a conventional ethanol perspective, they maxed us out at 15 billion gallons. In other categories, they shot a little low. So the biodiesel, renewable diesel folks had a very low renewable volume obligation. And that has really had a negative impact on the biodiesel market. So those are going to be some things as we move into a new set rule, which will have to be proposed and put together by the Trump administration. We're going to be working with them and advocating for a higher, more robust number because, again, the purpose of the renewable fuel standard was to become less dependent upon foreign sources of energy and become more energy independent here at home and to grow the amount of renewable fuel in that energy mix year over year. We're going to be asking the Trump administration to do just that, and we'll see where that goes.
Can the RFS be codified into law?
I will quote Majority Leader John Thune when I ran into him a couple of weeks ago. He said, it is way past time that we deal with the year-round E15 issue in Congress. So we're working on that. We came very close in December. If this really is a technical correction, really nothing more than that. It's missing a word, two words in the Clean Air Act that says E10 or more or higher in terms of an RVP waiver. So that's really the technical change that needs to be made. And we haven't been able to make that change for over 15 years because there's been a segment that really didn't want to see ethanol grow in terms of the volume and in the amount of space it consumes in the gas tank. All that world is changing. We have a coalition now that's made up of RFA and ag community and the American Petroleum Institute and some of their member companies that all see the value in making sure E15 has year-round certainty. And we feel like once that happens, you're going to see a pretty rapid adoption of E15 at the retail level. Just imagine we're at a 10% blend now. If we can move that 10% to a 15% blend, even if it's over 10 or 15 years, that's another 7 billion gallons of ethanol demand. That's another couple billion bushels of corn grind that will have to be done on an annual basis. All those things are going to be good for agriculture nationwide.
What's the future?
Look at what we can do within the gas tank. We can go to E15. We can go to E30 within the light-duty vehicle gas tank. All of those things are going to make liquid fuel burn cleaner for longer. And if people want to extend the life and the certainty of the internal combustion engine and liquid fuel long term, it's going to require more and more biofuel to be part of that mix.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
So let's actually once again set the baseline.
How serious is our debt crisis? Arizona Representative David Schweikert.
This one's about a year or so old. The numbers are actually slightly uglier. But you see the blue, non-defense and defense. Do you realize that's all a member of Congress gets to vote on? A member of Congress doesn't actually vote on the interest payments, the Social Security, the Medicare, Medicaid, other mandatory, because those are formulas now. Every dime a member of Congress votes on is borrowed money. And last year, every dime you voted on was borrowed money, and maybe $300-400 billion what you didn't vote on was borrowed money, because we actually spent more or borrowed more than every dime of what we call discretionary. And defense is discretionary. Remember, in today's world, Social Security is the number one spend. It's about 1.4, 1.5. Medicare is number two. Interest is number two. Interest is number two. Medicare is number three. And defense is actually number four. So the next time you have some brain trust saying, you know, if we just cut defense, sure, I'm sure there's efficiencies that we may find in defense. And I've been pushing for this, my third Congress in a row, trying to get an AI audit, because the Pentagon has failed for 8 years an audit. It's unaudible is the report we get back. So use AI at least to go through and stack the asset list, because you can't audit it if you don't know where the trucks are and other things. And in the security areas, fine. You do human auditing of those. Help us. Because it's finally actually risen to the surface of people saying, hey, maybe technology can help us save our society and our future and our economy. So when you take a look at what really goes on here in Congress, you got to understand your government is functionally an insurance company with an army. And almost 100% of the next 10 years of borrowing is interest and Medicare. And yet we're terrified to tell the public the truth. It's math. The math will win, but we've got to stop being fearful. And for those of you who, I'm going to show some of these, stop saying crazy stuff. You know, if your mission in life is to fill out comments or put out things or go on X and this and that and say things because you're basically your life mission is to be clickbait, don't you care enough about this republic to tell the truth of the scale? It's debt, deficit, and demographics. And you have a country, we have a country, that in 8 years, less than 8 years now, we'll have more deaths than births. We have a shortage of young people. And it really screws up the long-run math and the ability to be productive, the ability to actually raise wages, all those things. And that's why there are ways to make this work. We just have to do hard things, and you see how difficult it is to even have an honest conversation about the math around here. Look, I showed this last week. I'm only going to do it for a second. But for those people that run around this campus saying, let's just use current policy because that way I don't have to deal with the actual telling someone no. Baseline, by the end of this fiscal year, CBO says we'll be at $37,200,000,000 in borrowed money. If then CBO tells us over the next 9 budget years, 10 calendar years, we're going to borrow another $22 trillion. $37 trillion, another $22, and then if we were actually going to do the expiring tax provisions without finding a way to pay for them, that's $5.5 trillion, and then there's another $1.3 trillion of interest on top of that, and then many of the president's priorities are another $8 trillion when you add in the interest. You're functionally at $74 trillion of borrowing in the next 9 budget years. You basically have doubled U.S. debt.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Let's call it the modern era.
Former chairman of the House Ag Committee, co-author of the 2018 Farm Bill, Mike Conaway.
Part of it is you've got to manage expectations. And I know that's frustrating to people, but you've got 235 House members. And if you're going to get something done, you've got to find 217 friends. And one of those needs to be the speaker. And then you've got to find 60 friends in the Senate. And then you have to have a president willing to sign it. And our founding fathers put together a really daunting system to get things done. And I think that's on purpose because you don't want things get done, undone, done, and undone so that you get a whipsaw effects going on with policies flipping back and forth at the whim of if it were too easy to get done. So I know that people are frustrated. This, the 18 Farm Bill, which is really terrific for the times in which we wrote it, but it does not fit the times we live in today. We had low commodity prices in 2018, but input costs were a lot more rational. Today we have low commodity prices, and the input costs are stunningly not rational against those prices that which our farmers are trying to continue to feed us and provide the safest, most abundant, and least expensive food and fiber supply in the world. So I know that GT is frustrated, John Bozeman is frustrated, but I've got really high hopes that those two guys now leading the Senate and the House Ag Committees will get something done. I place some of the blame for lack of movement with now retired Senator Sabinow. She was really more interested in protecting SNAP and not allowing any changes to the SNAP program than she was getting a farm bill done. And I know that the rhetoric might be contrary to that, but the actions speak louder than words. It wasn't until super late in the system where she began to put out legislative language, those kind of things, whereas GT, as you said, got a bill through a committee, but was unable to get floor time, unable to get the to work down the floor. But it still takes 60 votes in the Senate. So John Bozeman will have the same kind of struggle that Pat Roberts had in 18. I'm excited about Amy Klobuchar's work on as ranking member over there that we can actually get things done. I think part of the help will be if they're able to get at the SNAP issue and the reconciliation bills, if they can take that off the table, which only takes 51 votes in the Senate, make those kind of changes that I know GT wants to make, some other changes I tried to get made in 2018, get those done in reconciliation, then that will free he and John up to address the non-SNAP portion of the bill, which is much less partisan. It's much more bipartisan to get something moving forward. The big issue, though, left, if they do get SNAP done, is there going to be new money for the non-SNAP portion of the farm bill? And that remains to be seen. Our nation is in a spending crisis. We're spending way too much money every single day. And so I would anticipate that it's going to be difficult for the budget committees to agree to new money for the farm bill, for the non-SNAP portions of the farm bill, which means if they want to change something in one title, they've got to move money out of a different title. And that means taking money away from people who have been getting it and giving it to the folks that may need it more. Those kind of Solomon-like decisions are going to have to get made. But if they can get SNAP off the table through reconciliation, then I think they've got a great chance of getting a farm bill done, maybe not by this September, but maybe in this calendar year, can get that done and reset the Title I programs, particularly to reflect the impact that higher input costs have had on the system, because things are just different than they were in 18, and the farm bill needs to be reflective of those new circumstances.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
You may have heard of Huayuli, a desert plant in Mexico and Texas's Big Bend region that produces rubber. Researchers such as USDA's Katrina Cornish are studying how to scale up Huayuli-based rubber production and in turn provide a significant rubber domestic supply.
We have farmers interested in growing it. We have manufacturers interested in buying the rubber to make it into things. We're missing that processing piece. How do you get the rubber out of the plant? Who is going to pay for that processing plant?
Expanding Huayuli-based rubber production is fueled both by potential economic opportunity, but also possible supply chain disruption.
When the rubber supply chain is interrupted, like in World War II or the oil embargo years when synthetic rubber became so expensive, natural rubber went with it, things like this, the tire industry has been most concerned and the ones most likely to put money into trying to develop these alternatives.
With research focused on developing Huayuli-based high-performance rubber and latex products that fill an unmet need in the market. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.